Hey everybody, welcome again to F This Movie. We are just days away from the release of The Dark Knight Rises, so what better movie to talk about than 1989's Batman, the one that started it all, and what better person to talk about Batman with than JB?
Wait till you get a load of me.
The B is for Batmaniac.
No, actually, the B is for bullshittery, which this film is full of.
You can find our website at fthismovie.blogspot.com. You can like us on Facebook, facebook.com/fthismovie. Follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fthismovie. Find us in the iTunes store and email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com. We are interested, hopefully by the end of this year, of moving things over from our blogspot to an official website with an official domain. But I'm not all that computer literate. If you are and you're listening and you know how to do these things, email us at fthismoviepodcast@gmail.com if you think you can help.
Because we've been told it isn't until you have your own domain name that you can start raking in the cash.
Remember, too, if you haven't bought your tickets yet for the F This Movie screening of Die Hard on August 2nd in Chicago, please do so. Go to our website to buy tickets or to click on the link so that you can buy tickets. It's happening for sure. 35mm screening of Die Hard. Come celebrate it with all of us.
It's going to be a lot of fun. Patrick will be wearing a white tank top.
Yes.
Which will get dirtier and dirtier as the film progresses. And then suddenly, it'll be black.
Yeah.
I think there's
just for a little while.
Continuity error.
Then it switches.
And there. I've heard a rumor that Doug, of Trailers with Doug fame, will be walking across broken glass barefoot.
JB, have you seen...
This is the first he's heard of.
Have you seen anything good lately?
My God, summertime and the living is easy. Fish are jumping and the cotton is high. Oh, I love the summer. You can start every day with a movie. I recently attended the Fathom Events TCM screening of Singing in the Rain.
Yes.
I guess the Casablanca thing a couple months ago went so well. Not only are they doing Singing in the Rain to trumpet, it's coming out on the Blu-rays next week or yesterday. At some time in the indeterminate future, Singing in the Rain will be on the Blu-rays, and so they sort of using this as a marketing opportunity. But during the screening, they had all these coming attractions for other Fathom events, most of which we don't have a lot of interest in. But apparently someone smells money, because in the fall, they're going to start doing it a lot. TCM partnering with Fathom Events, and this fall they're going to have screenings of To Kill a Mockingbird, Hitchcock's The Birds.
Ooh.
It looks as though the screenings that they did in several cities a couple months ago, that's when I saw The Birds with Tippi Hedren at the Music Box, those are the movies they're going to try and show one night only across the country. But the real exciting thing is, and I don't think off podcast I've told Patrick about this yet, on October 24th, nationwide, one night only, they're showing Frankenstein and The Bride of Frankenstein. Ooh. Double feature.
Very cool. How is the picture quality at these Fathom events?
It's good.
Okay.
And obviously part of it is they're showing off the new restoration.
Right.
Because in both cases the film was restored. I don't know if I have the best eye for this, but I think in my mind I have a very specific idea of how it's supposed to look. And I thought Casablanca looked great, but not awe-inspiring.
Okay.
I went, really, 4K scan on a big screen. And I've seen Singing in the Rain so many times, I was looking at, this defines the word minutia. I was looking for very specific things. For those of you who are big fans of Singing in the Rain, there's a line of dialogue in Gene Kelly and Debbie Reynolds' first scene that's obviously been looped, and looped really badly. And because I show it in class every semester, it sticks out for me. He turns to the side and says, "Dignified profession." And obviously they lost profession, and they had to grab it from another take, or maybe even another actor, because it sounds dignified profession. And I wondered if they were going to fix it, and they didn't. And then later, during the Broadway Melody sequence, when Gene Kelly is dancing with Sid Charisse, there's a very noticeable jump cut where I thought decades ago they lost a couple frames, and that's the best they can do. But now I think maybe Gene Kelly and Stanley Donen, his co-director, they were trying to cut together two different takes, and that was the best they can do.
Right.
I honestly thought they would try some sort of Jim Crackery to fix that, and they didn't. And I'm beginning to see why they might not want to, because the Universal horror films were announced
right.
a week or two ago
right.
on Blu-ray, and you go straight to the Classic Horror Film Board, where there are now 25 pages of middle-aged men who have never grown up bitching about something that hasn't come out based on this little featurette they released of how they're restoring Dracula and restoring the sound. And for decades, the opening Swan Lake theme had a little wow or flutter in it, and they fixed it by grabbing a piece of music from the Spanish version. Don't touch my memories, because apparently the Spanish version uses a different recording of Swan Lake, and that pretty much scotches the purchase of 8 Universal horror films on Blu-ray because of 3 seconds of music. Oh, my God.
That sounds the way it theoretically should sound.
Oh, my God.
It's not flawed.
Back to Singing in the Rain.
Yes.
Always wonderful to see it on a big screen. I went in the afternoon because it was offered as a matinee instead of at night. It was 200 ladies in their 80s. Literally.
Yeah.
Walkers, wheelchairs. Yeah. I was the youngest person there by 30 years.
Sweet.
And they
certainly, action.
Everyone really enjoyed it, and I thought it was great not only to see it on a big screen, but after Make 'Em Laugh, that musical number, and after Singing in the Rain, there was applause in the theater, which was good. And that one looked good, too. It wasn't looking as stunning as I expected, but what can you expect from a print that's... what anniversary is that film facing? 60.
Yeah.
60 years old. Also, and I'm going to lump all these together, I've recently seen Savages, To Roam with Love, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, and Take This Waltz.
Okay.
All of them, in their own individual ways, complete messes.
Interesting, okay.
Complete messes. And I go back to something you said, I think years ago, that you can see the script as you watch the film, and every page is a different color, because Savages is Oliver Stone trying to be Quentin Tarantino without a script by Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah.
Like he had for Natural Born Killers. To Roam with Love is my lovely wife has the best take on this. She feels that Midnight in Paris significantly increased Paris tourism.
Okay.
So the Italian Tourism Board came to Woody Allen and said, can you do the same for us? He looked through his desk, found 3 unfinished New Yorker pieces, said, these could take place in Italy. It defines a mess.
Okay.
It's just, it isn't even a movie.
It's
an idea for a movie. Actually, Alec Baldwin vindicates himself and shows how effortlessly good he is.
Yeah.
Other than that, we've spoken on the podcast before of the Alan Tarr, the actor in every Woody Allen film that, for some reason, acts just like him.
Jesse Eisenberg?
Well, yes and no.
Seems to be cast just
the only reason to see To Roam with Love and, you know, wait for it to be on cable or something. Ellen Page and Jesse Eisenberg have an Allen off.
Oh, wow.
They're both
doing
it.
Oh, boy.
Enough said, the better. You've spoken about Seeking a Friend.
Yes.
You found a lot of it very emotionally satisfying.
Well, I was affected by it emotionally. I wonder if seeing it again, removed from that, if I would like it at all.
I was affected by it emotionally.
Yes.
And I think both of us were for reasons that are completely beyond the film.
Probably.
And I file Seeking a Friend for the End of the World under the same category that I file Terms of Endearment, which the first time I saw it made me cry quite a bit. Until weeks later, I thought back to the film, and I thought, you have someone telling children that their mother's going to die.
Right.
It would actually be harder to film that scene and not have people cry.
Sure.
That would be the challenge.
Well,
and I think there's some things going on at the end of Seeking a Friend that touch the two of us for very specific reasons.
Sure.
I'll just leave it at that.
Okay.
Take This Waltz is a mess.
Yes.
And a really wonderful example of indie twee.
Okay.
Let's see. She has to decide between two guys. One of them writes cookbooks, and the other one pulls a rickshaw.
Oh, boy.
Wow. And
what is this, 1997?
While I'd admit that Michelle Williams is easy on the eyes, and I could just watch a movie. No, she's something.
She's such like a little, every time she shows up in an awards show with her little pixie haircut, and she's so tiny, and we have to clap or she'll die. I can't stand it.
I'm not speaking to her for real. I'm speaking about her on the screen.
Got it.
She's made up and lit.
Sure.
And, boy, howdy.
Okay.
The reason to see Take This Waltz, assuming that you can see it somehow for free, is Seth Rogen.
Yeah.
Who just quietly turns in the best performance in the film. And as you pointed out, he was the best thing in 50-50.
Yeah.
And he has such a reputation as being the stoner goofball
right. In
real life, and he mostly appears in comedies, that he's slowly building up this body of work where he's also a very interesting dramatic actor.
Well, he's very, very natural, and people make that seem like that's easy, and it's not. That's really hard to do.
But there's actually a scene in Take This Waltz where he's actually expected to do some heavy lifting. Trying to think of how to describe this without spoiling it. It's a lengthy take of him that's broken up with cuts, so it's not continuous. There's all these jump cuts, but mm-hmm. It's basically a close-up of him sitting at a table reacting to some very emotional news. And it's,
is that someone who's just seen Sarah Silverman's vagina?
Well, I kind of knew you were going to bring that up. The director,
it's like the brown bunny. There's just one thing we can talk about.
Sarah Polley has brought up that she wanted to portray female nudity realistically. So we get this scene where three people are in the shower and two of them are Michelle Williams and Sarah Silverman. And then the camera cuts to three much older women to sort of make this point that they're young and beautiful now. But, you know, everyone gets old and flabby, I guess. But the point that Polly has made in more than one interview is that men don't realize that women see each other naked all the time.
Right.
And that this is a very realistic view of nudity. And I bounced this off my wife, and she said, no, that's not true at all.
Yeah.
Unless 20-somethings have a whole new anything-goes attitude.
I think there's some of that is true, but I don't think that it's even in the same context of...
I'm not a woman.
...the movie.
Whoa. I'm not.
Okay.
I'm a man, and I don't think in 4 years I ever saw my college roommate naked.
No.
Did?
No. It doesn't. Whatever. However you want to be is fine, but I just started taking my son to swimming lessons, and I'm amazed at how free some men are in the locker room. Like, take it easy, guy. You have a shower at home. Come on.
Then I think that either it's a 20s and 30s thing, or I have led my life with communal shower phobia, as Woody Allen calls it.
Savages I saw, so we can spend a couple minutes talking about Savages. I saw Seeking a Friend, but I have not yet seen To Roam With Love. I feel like I kind of know how I feel about it. I feel like I know exactly where it fits in terms of, like, which one of Woody Allen's movies this is. It's about as good as, you
everything
know,
like, that kind of worked in Paris doesn't work in this.
Okay.
And once again reminds us, Woody Allen went through a 10-year period where almost every movie he made was awful.
Exactly.
And then he had a couple.
Right.
I really like Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
As do I.
I really like Midnight in Paris. I like Match Point.
But also remember that Scoop is in there. And people don't remember that Scoop is one of those... act like he had this perfect run,
right.
But...
And I didn't see Scoop.
Oh.
And I didn't see Tall Dark Stranger.
Oh.
And I didn't see the one with Will Ferrell.
Melinda and Melinda.
See?
Yeah, see, this is To Roam With Love. That's what I
knew.
By
skipping things like, what was it called? Whatever Works.
Oh, yeah?
I didn't go to.
Oh, well, come on.
And Anything Else? Is that what it was called? The one with Christina Ricci?
Yes. Which, by the way, Quentin Tarantino named as maybe one of the best, his favorite movies of the decade. Of the decade!
Is he messing with us?
He's not. He has crazy taste.
He has plenty of time to mess with us because he didn't write the screenplay to Savages. Would you agree that everyone in Savages is in a different movie?
Yes. No. I think the two guys are in the same movie.
I didn't know till it was over, and my...
But that was Kick-Ass?
Very erudite son told me that. Wow.
Yeah.
I was very impressed by that.
Here's the thing about Savages. I didn't dislike Savages while it was on, even though I knew that it was kind of a nonsensical mess, but it held my attention, and I thought it was pretty entertaining. I thought the ending was pretty terrible. It's, you know, an empty movie. It's an exercise in style that doesn't quite match what he's trying to do. I remember seeing the trailer and feeling like, hey, Oliver Stone is copying Tony Scott, who at one point sort of adopted Oliver Stone's Natural Born Killers aesthetic in everything he did, and now the dog is eating its own tail. I thought some of the dialogue was truly... It gave me douche chills.
When
Blake Lively says, I have orgasms, he has wargasms. I wanted to cut my throat.
He was trying to fuck the war out of himself. And that's some of the narration, all of which is completely unnecessary.
Yes.
Not one sentence of the narration is necessary.
Well, again, I feel like, you know, this is adapted from a book, and the author of the book co-wrote the screenplay. And it's a very popular book, sort of this cult crime fiction. And I just have a feeling like, well, the book is narrated by O. The fact that the character's name is O makes me throw up in my mouth. And so they brought that over to the movie, but it's not necessary.
Completely unnecessary. And it seemed to me that it's an Oliver Stone film where he's obviously not firing on all cylinders. And it seems to be trying to be a Quentin Tarantino film, but he had nothing to do with it. And it almost seems like it's aspiring to aspects of Elmore Leonard.
Yeah.
But Elmore Leonard had nothing to do with it. So it's a mank of a foe of a fake of a fake.
Yeah.
Instantly forgettable.
Yeah, I enjoyed it while I was on. A great performance from Benicio Del Toro.
He's the only one who vindicates himself.
Yeah.
And he's in a completely different movie.
Yeah.
He's in a much, much darker film than anyone else.
Yeah.
And then there's Salma Hayek, who...
Who's getting a lot of good reviews for the movie, but I thought she was kind of laughable. I don't know. It tries to do a couple of things.
At no point do you believe that she could be actually in charge.
Right.
And that all of her
And it tries to explain it away that she sort of inherited this.
Right.
She doesn't even necessarily want
it. But clearly her underlings are terrified of her.
Right.
For no apparent reason.
Right, because she's kind of a softie. I don't know. It's a mess. But you know who I thought was pretty good was, what's his name? John Carter. Taylor Kitsch. And he's had a really bad year.
Oh, I didn't put that together either.
Oh, for real?
So it's John Carter and Kick-Ass as the yin and the yang.
And Taylor Kitsch is in John Carter, and he's kind of miscast, and the movie tanks. And he's in Battleship, and that movie tanks. I mean, he's had a bad year. They keep trying to make him a movie star in movies that...
And I'm guessing Savages isn't...
It's doing okay, but not, you know... But who's going to go see that in a summer with Batman and Spider-Man and the Avengers? And but I actually thought... I thought he was good in the movie. It's the first time I saw him that I thought, oh, I get what you might be in a movie. You know what I mean? I don't know. I didn't hate the movie, but I totally agree that it's a mess. I'll just talk about one movie real quick that I watched on Netflix Instant that I won't recommend in our new column that you probably haven't read yet, but it starts tomorrow, everyone.
It's going to be the greatest thing ever.
It is a documentary called The Rockafire Explosion. And you have to watch this movie because it kept reminding me of some documentaries that we've talked about in the past, mostly Cinemania. It's only about an hour long. It focuses on a very small group of mostly men, only three or four, who are obsessed with the animatronic rock band that used to be featured at Showbiz Pizza Place.
I saw the trailer for this.
The Rockafire Explosion.
Yeah.
And the inventor of that Rockafire Explosion. So these are the people that are profiled in the movie. And it's really interesting. And again, the movie doesn't necessarily try and pass judgment on them and say that these guys are damaged or messed up or pathetic. In some ways, you could draw your own conclusion. But again, this thing makes them happy. But it's this fascinating look at...
One of them...
People who are unable to let go of something.
One of them has purchased and refurbished.
Yes.
And it's in his garage or basement.
It's in his house.
Yeah.
His own Rockafire Explosion.
That's what I remember from the trailer.
Yeah.
This sounds really good.
It is. It's great. And I have to talk about something, and I apologize if this gives something away in the movie, but I just thought it was so great. It was one of my favorite moments in a movie this year. They're interviewing the inventor, whose warehouse, you know, his 300 employees have long since been fired. He's not making these things anymore, but he still has everything in his warehouse, and it's a mess, but he still works there. It's again, he's another guy who isn't able to move on or let go of this thing. So we're interviewing him, and then separately we're interviewing all the fans of the Rockefeller explosion. And it's three or four guys who look, again, kind of what you expect them to look like, because they're obsessed with this one little piece of showbiz pizza history. But there's this one girl, and she's on the younger side, but she's very attractive. And it does not fit. You're just wondering, well, how did this happen? How is this girl obsessed with this weird showbiz thing? Because she almost seems too young for it. She had worked at a Chuck E. Cheese, and she was introduced to the Rockefeller explosion maybe through YouTube videos or something. I don't know. And you're about 40 minutes into the movie, and then you meet the guy who purchased his own Rockefeller, the biggest fan, I would say, who only drinks Mountain Dew, by the way, only. No water, no tea, no other sodas. The only thing he drinks is Mountain Dew. You meet his wife, who he met at the skating rink that he worked. And so this is the little part of the movie where we talk about the relationships. So we meet his wife, and then it cuts to the inventor, and sitting next to him is his young wife, the very attractive girl who's been interviewed throughout the movie. It was just this great reveal of like, oh, so that's who you get. You found the cute one, and you married her because you're the star. You're the guy who made this thing, and this is your prize. It was, and it's very, their interview is very uncomfortable. Very uncomfortable. He's speaking for her, and she seems sort of lost. It's great. It's only about an hour long. It's on Netflix Instant.
I feel like going upstairs and watching it right now.
The Rockefeller explosion.
I think
everyone.
We can dispense with Batman pretty quickly, because I would like to see the Rockefeller
explosion. Let's talk
explosion.
About Batman from 89.
Da, 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 da.
Now, I'm sure to some extent we're going to get hammered on this, because this is a movie that people have tremendous affection for, and I understand why. At one point in my life, the summer that Batman came out, I mean, this was the biggest. I can't even describe how big of a deal this was to me. I could not have been more excited about this movie. The summer it came out, I think I had basically 7 Batman t-shirts that were just in a rotation. I wore a Batman shirt every day. I lined up at the theater hours early because I was convinced it was going to sell out.
The t-shirts were big.
Yes.
And
everything was big.
I've always known that this was the first movie where one of the actors received profit participation on the tchotchkes.
Yeah.
Nicholson asked for a percentage of the loot.
Yeah.
So he got t-shirt money. And it's very telling. In one of the several making of features that are part of the Blu-ray, he says that it got to the point where, because the studio had no idea how popular it would be, a lot of places ran out of junk.
Yeah.
And you have to order these things to be manufactured. So it's not like you can call China and say, send us more. And he was actually very upset and disappointed that you don't have the supply for the demand of t-shirts and other assorted paraphernalia.
Well, there were knockoffs. I mean, I was wearing knockoff t-shirts too. Like, it was everywhere. It was the biggest deal. So I was super excited, and this is obviously sort of the first. I mean, they had made Superman, but by 89, Superman had been run into the ground thanks to the quest for peace. So this was the big comic book movie, and as a comic book fan, I mean, I was way, way into comic books at this point. Here was a movie that looked like it was going to take things seriously, and here was, you know, Batman had been done on TV, but it was a goof, and they kind of made fun of it, and he was wearing the goofy tights, and here's the cool-looking Batman suit and the incredible sets, Jack Nicholson, he's the Joker, and it's all a big deal. So at 12 years old, I think, I sit down to watch Batman, and of course, in theory, I love it, because it's all these things that I want to see live action, you know? But even I think at 12, I guess I was, some part of me knew that, like, oh, this movie as a movie isn't quite great.
And I was 27, and obviously you could not be immune to the hype. I mean, it was everywhere that summer. Again, on the making of, they said that once it was revealed at what theaters you could see the trailer, when the trailer first came out, that people were paying to see the trailer and then going home.
Yeah.
That they weren't staying for the film. And yeah. I certainly don't remember that, but well, I again, do this remember.
It's before the internet. I mean, now that kind of thing doesn't exist, but back then that was the only way you could see it.
And I remember seeing it, I believe I was 27, and thinking, okay,
right.
That's a thing. It didn't bowl me over. If you have very warm feelings about this film in your heart, I am not going to argue with the 12-year-old
right,
you.
Right.
I would suggest, though, that either before or after you listen to the podcast, sit down and watch it again. Because I did. And oh my God.
Now, let me ask you this, because I agree, I don't think the movie has aged well at all. And I think it's a bigger mess than people have ever recognized. But it's a hard thing to talk about, because I want to talk about, I mean, some of the things that I think the movie does right, and there are a few. I don't want to necessarily, it's hard for me to not talk about it just in terms of, like, having seen The Dark Knight, it's very hard to now go back and watch the Tim Burton Batman, because now the Tim Burton Batman might as well be the TV show compared to The Dark Knight. So it's hard to talk about
and that,
post-Dark Knight.
And that made me think that, well, I guess everything is a relative term.
Yeah.
Because the buzz when the Tim Burton Batman came out was, they're finally doing it seriously.
Right.
They're finally not doing it as a goof.
Right.
This is going to be really dark.
Right.
But there's a difference between turning off the lights and having the tone of something be dark.
Right.
So, lately, I've been seeing everything as a battle between irony and genuineness. And I think this explains part of the malaise that this country is in right now, and certainly the malaise that a lot of entertainment is in right now. Safety Not Guaranteed deals with this issue very eloquently. That the TV Batman, which I loved, because I was five.
Yeah.
I was five when that thing was on TV. Oh, you would watch it, and then they were going to kill him, and then you had to watch it the next night. They didn't tell you.
It was a ton of fun, and again, as a kid,
It was great for five-year-olds.
But I would watch it in reruns because it was the only thing I could see that had superheroes on it.
And I would argue that a lot of the campiness and irony of the original TV show was for adults. Because as a five-year-old, he's in a suit and he's fighting crime, and I don't get the joke.
Right.
And obviously you look at it now and it's problematic because it's really silly.
Yeah.
So they announced that Tim Burton's Batman was going to go back to the comic strip and it was going to be dark. And it is dark, but it's not genuine. It's still ironic.
Yeah.
They're still doing it with a wink. That maybe for 1989, because the 80s were a hell of a decade, let me tell you, I was there. Maybe for the 80s, it was dark. But obviously, things have gotten a lot darker, or I'm a lot older, because except for the lighting design and some of the set and costume design, which, of course, in a Tim Burton film is always top flight, this film looks good, for the most part, that it's not darkly themed at all. And I would suggest that about halfway through, it throws that to the wind and just becomes something very different for reasons we'll talk about. And that, like it or hate it, I think most people like it, the Christopher Nolan films are very genuine. And that what he brought to it, and my first impression of Batman Begins was, he's doing it realistically so that you can watch it and say, that can actually happen. And no one's winking. And even the way he did the Joker was very, very different. I love what Mark Ahn wrote about it in our sequels column, that Heath Ledger's Joker is terrifying.
Mm-hmm.
And that movie's rated PG.
It's PG-13.
PG-13. Right. That's a pretty hard trick to carry off. So either 1989 was a very different period of time that I don't quite remember, or what this film was celebrated for, it doesn't, in fact, deliver.
I don't think it delivers it anymore. I mean, I think to some extent it delivered it in 1989. And again, we're into this issue of, this is hard, because comic book fans, you know, are quick to jump on us, especially when we talk about comic book movies. And certainly there are different approaches you can take to any source material. So, I'm not condemning the Tim Burton Batman for not, for being much more stylized and comic booky than the Christopher Nolan Batman. I recognize that you can take two separate approaches and both can work. I just don't necessarily think that the Tim Burton one does, aside from some of the production design, which is great.
Right, and I'm suggesting that one of the ways that this film was sold,
yes,
was a shock.
Okay.
That we get this very moody, impressionistic opening.
Yeah.
And then we get the celebrated shot, I believe it was in the trailer, where the Joker is reading the newspaper, the lighting is really chiaroscuro, his face in that shot looks exactly like the comic book face. Way do they get a load of me?
Mm-hmm.
And it's almost exactly at that point that the film goes off the tracks, and we get scenes like the art gallery scene that could have been in the 1960s television show.
And watching it this time, and without us speaking about that ahead of time, that was the exact impression I got as I watched him dancing around. He's doing Cesar Romero. I mean, it's exactly the same. And I think, you know, Tim Burton's argument, or not that I'm speaking for Tim Burton, was that the reason that it's darker is because the Joker actually hurts and or kills people.
Yes.
But the tone of the character and the performance is the exact same as Cesar Romero.
And gets progressively crazier and crazier. Also, yeah. in the realm of, I'm looking at this movie and I'm seeing a script with many different color pages.
Yeah.
In the making of materials that are included as part of the Blu-ray, they introduce they interview rather
Sam Hamm.
Sam Hamm,
yeah,
who blatantly says,
"Yeah,
not me.
This was taken away from me at one point.
Not me, not me." Because
right.
Obviously, comic book fans are passionate about things, and they have confronted him on many occasions. One gets the feeling and have said, what the hell? And he said, not me. And we'll get to some of those minutes in a second. One of the things that makes the art gallery scene stand out, though, is that I don't know whose decision it was to involve Prince in this film.
That's a studio decision.
Because he was a Warner Brothers artist.
Right.
And we
can sell a soundtrack.
But we already have a soundtrack because Elfman has written a symphonic score. So we're going to release the Prince as a separate album inspired by.
Right.
And the other amazing bonus feature on the Blu-ray.
The Bat Dance video?
The three music videos. There's three of them.
I didn't watch the other one.
I defy you to get through all three.
Party Man, Bat Dance.
And it's a little slower song.
Okay.
I think it might be playing.
Scandalous?
Yeah.
Okay. I had the soundtrack.
When
I listened to it a lot
and
when
I
was 12.
I used to have the soundtrack because it came in this little black tin can, which I was very enamored of, but I don't think I ever spun the CD. I was a sucker for packaging. That at one point it seems like Prince is shoved on Tim Burton, that Tim Burton is not happy about this.
Yeah.
Because in one of the opening scenes where Bruce Wayne is hosting this fundraiser at his mansion, and it's sort of casino night, there's a Prince song playing very, very yeah. quietly in the background. And it might be Scandalous, but don't quote me. So we have that one, we have Party Man, and then
Bat Dance.
And that's during the parade.
No, Trust is during the parade. Bat Dance never plays in the movie.
Does Bat Dance play during the end credits?
I don't think so.
Bat
Dance was like the hit, though.
Right.
Yeah.
No, I remember that because yeah. it not only contains the familiar TV theme,
right.
but, and I had to remind myself that this wasn't quite as common in the late 80s, little snatches of dialogue.
Yeah.
Vicky Vale. Vicky Vale. I'm Batman.
Yep.
I'm Batman.
And the video is amazing because it's Prince as half Batman, half Joker, and then armies of dancing Batmans and Jokers.
But the Batmen are obviously women
right.
because of their secondary sex characteristics.
It's,
and there's one woman who's one of the many dancing Jokers who does a really good face. She makes a face and she looks
right.
like the Joker. And there's like 10 close-ups of her. But it's an army of women dressed as Batman dancing.
And again, this had never happened. I mean, there's so many ways you could talk about this movie. You could spend an hour just talking about the fact that no movie before this was marketed in such a way, had this kind of crazy attention around it, had this kind of push, like the soundtrack and the ridiculous song that's now part of the movie. And I don't think it's ever happened since. I mean, I can't think of a movie.
On a much, much smaller scale, I remember when that ridiculous MC Hammer thing was grafted onto the Addams Family movie.
Sure. Yeah, no. That's
and that just had marketing men right. all over it.
But they were chasing this, you know.
If you ever get a chance to see the original Bat Dance music video, it is the definition of batshit crazy.
I'm sure it's on YouTube. I'm sure you can see it.
It's insane. Check it out. So he has these Prince songs fobbed upon him.
Yeah.
And the Prince song in the art gallery is another element that adds to it. We have characters sort of stepping out and doing ironic commentary, the famous line from the art gallery scene, where does he get those wonderful toys?
Right.
And that doesn't quite work. But where the film really goes off the tracks, and this is really what I wanted to talk about,
okay.
because I'm patting myself on the back. I'm watching Batman again, the Tim Burton Batman, for I don't think I'd seen this movie in 20 years. And I'm watching it again. And at the end, when they go up to the top of the church or wherever that is, the Joker is seen next to a gargoyle of some sort, a big statue of some sort, and the wind is blowing, and I'm watching it, and I have proof. I didn't just say this to myself, so there's no proof later. I have witness. I turned to my lovely wife, and I said, that looks exactly like a shot in the original Lon Chaney Phantom of the Opera. Exactly. And I thought, there's a bunch of things in this film that look a lot like other films. There's shots of Gotham that look like they're from Metropolis. Mm-hmm. When they go up those improbable wooden stairs to yep. get to the top of the cathedral, mm-hmm. it seems odd that a stone cathedral would have these rickety wooden stairs
right.
until you realize the stairs are from Vertigo
oh.
because there's a shot going down the steps that's... Okay. It looks exactly like the Hitchcock film.
Okay.
So I'm watching this and I'm going, the shot of the Joker next to the gargoyle looks exactly like the Phantom of the Opera. I mean, that can't be a coincidence. And my wife said, I think that's stretching a little bit. So I finish watching the film and I begin to watch the interminable making of, and Jack Nicholson and Peter Guber
yeah.
start talking about what a collaborative atmosphere it was on the set. And Nicholson goes on and on. They really sought my input, and I really felt I was... And I'm like, uh-oh, I know where this is going. And then they cut to Goober. The script is a blueprint.
Yeah.
It's
yeah, yeah.
just a blueprint.
Right.
And I see what's coming. Halfway through the shooting of Tim Burton's Batman, Nicholson and Goober attended a screening of the Lon Chaney Phantom of the Opera. And that's where they got the idea, and they said, let's do that.
Okay.
And they had the end of the film rewritten.
Maybe.
No.
Oh, you know this for sure?
Yes.
Oh, this wow. is in... Oh, get out of town.
No, this is not conjecture.
Okay.
So not only am I patting myself on the back
yeah.
for saying...
Yeah.
No. No. And I know this is a very personal thing because it so bothers me when this happens that everyone associated with a film thinks they should be able to
right.
contribute.
Right.
That's the screenwriter's job.
Right.
Sam Hamm is not telling Nicholson, and I'm just going to play the Joker in this scene. But everyone, you know, the studio suits that I usually characterize as non-creative garbage, ooh, everyone gives notes.
Yeah.
Because everyone. Well, where were you 2 months ago where I was staring at a blank page? Mm-hmm. See, everyone can rewrite a script, but very few people can write a script.
Right.
So... if that's what happened to the end of this film, I wonder how many little times it happened. Because think about it. What is the Joker trying to do in this film?
Gas everyone in Gotham City.
I don't know. And that's what he's trying to do during the parade, and he uses the money to lure them.
Right.
If he's trying to lure them to a parade to gas them to death,
yes.
then what do the beauty products have to do with that?
That is another way to kill everyone in Gotham.
Do they have to use the beauty products so for the gas to work?
But the beauty products, that plan had already been foiled by the time the gas rolls around.
Okay.
Batman fucked that up.
No, I'm not done yet.
Okay.
If he's trying to kill everyone in Gotham.
Yes. Plan A was
beauty products.
Right.
And then plan B was the gas.
Yeah.
what is the thing in the art gallery where he's redoing paintings,
yeah.
he scars his girlfriend,
right.
and he said he's going to become the first homicidal artist. How does that fit in?
I feel like it's a less focused version of what they set up in the Christopher Nolan Batman, which is just the Joker's plan is anarchy.
Right. But that's made very clear in the Nolan film.
Exactly. And I feel like it's just not made clear in this one.
It comes across in the Burton film as accidental.
Yeah, maybe.
That they pursued one thread.
Yeah, maybe.
And then they quickly drop it
yeah.
for another rewrite of the script.
Right. I mean, I definitely think it's a case of, you know, a big deal was made when Jack Nicholson signed on to play the Joker.
Yes.
Because, hey, that gives this legitimacy.
Instantly credibility.
And Tim Burton is, it's very early in his career. He's made two movies, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which was a big hit, Beetlejuice, which was a big hit. But now he's being handed the reins of arguably the biggest movie ever. And I will say, you know, he directs it with confidence. The storytelling is a mess, but that would go on to be a touchstone of every Tim Burton movie.
Looks good.
Yeah, but there's definitely, I think it's definitely a case of we have a young, fairly inexperienced director that can be kind of steamrolled, you know, by guys like Peter Guber and Jack Nicholson.
So I kept waiting for a big mechanical spider to show up.
Jack Nicholson signs on. That was,
that famous
was John Peters.
Famous yeah. Kevin Smith story about Wild Wild West.
Nicholson signs on, and definitely at that point, the script starts to change a lot because it becomes the Joker show. I mean,
and
the movie is the Joker show.
Sam Hamm even admits, once you've signed Nicholson,
yeah.
you want to give him something to do.
So the movie is almost entirely the Joker. Batman is sort of a supporting character in his own movie, and I watched some of the special features. Actually went through each of the movies and watched some of the special features because there's this four-part or five-part documentary. I forget, Shadows of the Bat, it's called.
Yeah.
And it's on each one, so
yeah.
they kind of take you through each movie. And Tim Burton's talked about, on Batman Returns, they're talking about why does that movie feel so dominated by the Penguin and the Catwoman? Well, A, you could argue because Tim Burton is only interested in the freaks. But he says, well, those people that ask that question, they don't get the character of Batman because he is, I forget the word he uses. It's not private, but like he's secretive. He doesn't want to be front and center. And that to me seems like such a weird backwards argument for why he's not in your movie enough, because you could still make a movie about a guy who wants to remain in the shadows. That doesn't mean that you literally put him in the shadows in his movie and just let other characters. You can do whatever you want to
the
character.
Made the decision, you've made the decision to make him brooding.
Right.
But it's Burton who goes one step further and says, let him brood over there, away from the reach of my camera.
Such a weird argument to make for why your main character isn't in your movie. But he's definitely way, way sidelined in the first Batman, too. And again, there was a big brouhaha when they named Michael Keaton. And Tim Burton's argument was always like, well, no, Michael Keaton is kind of an odd guy. And you want a guy who would need to put on a suit to feel normal or something. And, I mean, I don't have a problem with Michael Keaton in the movie. Again, it's a weird casting choice. But there's nothing to that character, and again, I don't mean to keep comparing it to the Christopher Nolan Batman, but, you know, sometimes when they say, hey, if the best criticism for a movie is to make a better movie.
Make another movie.
And Christopher Nolan gets a lot of those things right. He focuses on the character of Bruce Wayne and Batman, but he also understands something about that character, which is that he's driven by obsession. And I don't feel like the Bruce Wayne in Tim, I mean, can you describe Bruce Wayne in Tim Burton's Batman to me, except that he's rich and he dresses up like Batman.
And
he's haunted.
Michael Keaton is so downplaying it when he's Bruce Wayne.
Yeah.
That it sort of reminded me of Robin Williams, who has two modes. the fake sincerity, low key, first gear, and then batshit. But I have actual mathematical proof that Tim Burton has no interest in what motivates Batman. And I wanted to talk to you about this. At the beginning of the film, we see a family comprised of a husband, a wife, and a small child. Mm-hmm. And they seem to be emerging from some sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And they're getting lost in the city, and they're set upon by thieves. And I am not a comic book guy, but I am familiar with the story of Batman. Yep. And I think to myself, okay, I see what's going on here. And as it turns out, they are set upon by thieves, and Batman shows up to foil the crime. So this is Tim Burton slapping comic book fans and deliberately misleading them.
Yeah.
We think, right, given that the production design never makes it clear if we're in the 80s or the 40s, he is leading us to think that this is the origin, and right, it's not, because right, Batman arrives fully formed. And I don't know.
Which is, by the way, one of the things I like about the movie.
That it starts.
But he's
that.
Batman. We don't have to mess around. No, I don't necessarily mean that it starts with that scene. That we don't have, you know, we just did this show on The Amazing Spider-Man, and we get the origin yet again. Yes. And it's that we don't have to go through the origin of Batman. That it's dealt with in a little flashback scene, but for the most part,
well, see, that's,
he's Batman.
That's where I have a problem. I also noticed in that opening scene where he foils the crooks that the bat suit at that point in its evolution is so incredibly heavy, yeah, and clunky,
yeah,
that it's a series of tableau of Michael Keaton posing, yeah, in it. That it doesn't work at all.
Well, look at those action sequences at the end of the movie. I mean, they're so stiff and clumsy because you can't move around in that thing.
The suit doesn't work.
It looks cool.
Again, back to my point that Tim Burton really doesn't care what motivates Batman. We don't get the actual origin for an hour and a half. And it's sort of tossed off, yeah, as, and it's got that horrible shot of the pearls in the popcorn,
right,
whatever that means. Because, you know, when I think of great tragedy, I think that's pearls and popcorn.
That might even be a frame from a comic book.
It really looks like one.
Yeah. Because it borrows heavily from a couple years maybe before this came out. I mean, the Frank Miller Batman is obviously, I think, what gave Burton the inspiration to do it dark and gritty. But Alan Moore did a book called The Killing Joke, which sort of tells the origin of the Joker, and this is borrowed very heavily from The Killing Joke. And I don't remember if... But again, in the comics, it was not young Joker that killed
Batman's
parents.
That comes up during the making of
Ventures 2. That's what Sam Hamm said, is not me.
And someone decided that would all tie it together, and you get that... I think a lot of people like it. I really hate it.
I made you, you made me first.
Yeah.
Okay, and it's horrible. And even at 12, I was like, oh, this is not good. And I think the 12-year-old me was reacting to, that's not how it is in the comic. But again, that doesn't make or break a movie. The problem is that it's just bad and lazy. At the same time, that's the closest the movie gets to sort of stating a theme.
Yes.
That's it. And yeah, it's bad. But, like, that's it.
And it takes baby steps toward a theme that I give Nolan so much credit for. That in The Dark Knight Returns...
Dark Knight Rises?
No, the second one.
The Dark Knight.
The Dark Knight.
Batman Returns.
You see how interested I really am in it. Everyone's always returning because there's another sequel to be made. That Nolan makes it explicit. We're the same guy.
Right, right.
So... why do you feel the need to pussyfoot around it? I think in the Burton version, the reason they're pussyfooting around it is that it's the result of another script revision, and nothing organically in the early parts of the film has led to that.
Right.
It's a last, what right, if we did this?
Right, right, right. And that's one of the things, you know, Batman Returns has some things about it that are better and more interesting. There are tons of people who claim that Batman Returns is the single best Batman movie ever made.
For what it's worth,
yeah,
I like that one a lot more than Batman.
Okay.
For reasons I can't quite put my finger on, maybe because he felt the first one did all the heavy lifting in terms of establishing the character, there's stuff in Batman Returns that's so crazy and weird.
Well, it's much darker, even tone-wise. It's much more mean-spirited. It feels much more like a Tim Burton movie. And I wonder how much of that is Batman makes all the money in the world, and now the studio is a little bit more comfortable saying, okay, make your movie.
And the studio,
after Batman Returns, they basically say, okay, Tim, you're done, because children are crying, and this is not the direction we want to go. But Batman Returns sort
children of... cried in Batman Returns?
Oh, yeah.
What made them cry?
Oh, they were terrified. That movie is hateful. I mean, the Penguin is such
a
miserable...
Yeah.
Just the whole tone of it is, like, ugly. It's an ugly movie. I don't mean looking, but Batman Returns does sort of come out and say, hey, we're all freaks, the three of us. Catwoman, Penguin, Batman, we're basically all the same. We're all freaks caught up in this weird thing. So Batman Returns is a little bit more explicit in terms of what it's about. It's less confused thematically, I guess, than the first Batman.
It's crazy, but I think it's very true what you're saying, that Batman is such a hit. I mean, just a gigantic hit, that they're willing to give him a little bit more leeway. And I believe the success of Batman is what allowed him to make Edward Scissorhands.
I believe so, yeah.
If I'm getting the chronology right.
It allowed him to make the rest of the movie in his movies in his career, basically.
Another thing I thought was so odd, you don't mind me moving on to something else.
Not at all. As long as it's still Batman.
In Dark Shadows, what I didn't understand, Robert Wall is this newspaper reporter.
Yeah.
And he's in the beginning of the film.
Yeah.
And then the film loses all interest in that because he exists and introduces to Vicki Vale. I'm watching it again after so many years. Is not Robert Wall one of the most self-satisfied performers ever?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, he built a whole TV show around his sense of smugness.
Arliss,
yeah.
And every minute he's in the film, he exudes, I'm so happy to be in this film.
Yep.
And actually, on the making of, he expresses great regret that they didn't put him in the sequel.
Mm-hmm.
But at one point early in the film, he's this crusading reporter, and he wants to prove that the Batman exists, because of course everyone's denying it. And he walks into the newspaper office, and a character who I'm assuming is the editorial cartoonist...
Bob Kane?
Yes. Hands him a piece of paper in which Bob Kane, the creator of the character, has drawn this little caricature to prove that he thinks that Robert Wall's character is crazy. And, of course, he signed it Bob Kane.
Yeah.
So we're hit over the head by the fact that this is the creator cameo. And as Robert Wall walks away from the desk, he says, what a dick. He says that. Was everyone laughing that day at that hilarious bon mot? I mean, what the fuck? What the fuck does that mean?
Bob Kane is a dick.
No. Was it the entire movie company testing if Bob Kane was a good sport? What possible reason
could there be?
Can you think of any other example in a movie? Picture any one of these Marvel movies during Stan Lee's...
Check out this asshole. Just Stanley.
They show Stanley
shitting himself.
They show Stanley's cameo. Look at that shit. Who does this?
I don't know.
It's in the first 10 minutes of the movie. What are they thinking?
Right. So maybe it's just, hey, we need a laugh here, and the best we can come up with is what a dick. Or maybe, on a deeper level, this is a movie that has no respect for the Batman character or its mythos, and is willing to shit on the man who created it.
And what makes me hate that line...
I don't believe that second one, by the way.
What makes me hate that line even more is, again, from this copious making-of feature, they interview his widow, because Bob Kane has passed on. And she recounts going to the premiere.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the limo, and there's thousands of people lined up to see the film and lined up to see the stars. And apparently, Bob Kane began to cry and say, I can't believe that this thing that I created is so interesting to all these people.
Yeah.
And that's very heartfelt.
Yeah.
But to that, this film replies, what a dick. What a dick to be moved by the fact that you created something that people like.
Yeah.
I think the only performer in this film that escapes unscathed and watching it again really made me see how much I like this actor, and he gets no attention. I love Pat Hingle,
Okay.
He's Commissioner Gordon.
Yeah.
And if one of the problems with this film is that it said it's going to do the Dark Batman, but it wasn't really interested in doing that, that it said it was going to be genuine, but it actually veers off into irony like the 60s TV show, Pat Hingle's performance is nothing but genuineness.
That's true.
And I've never seen him give a bad performance. I love Pat Hingle.
Yeah, no, he's good.
He used to do a lot of TV.
Yeah. I feel like I saw him in something not that long ago that he was not great in, but it's fine. It's fine. I actually, yeah, I'm not... I
think the last time I saw him in a movie,
yeah,
he was really quite a bit older.
Yeah, right.
And I wondered why he had been cast.
Again, I like a lot of the actors independently. I mean, I like Michael Goff just from those crazy 60s horror... What's the one where he's got the killer zoo?
I don't remember. He's in a lot of Hammer films.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But nobody's given much to do. I mean, you can't really describe who any of these people are with the exception of the Joker. And maybe it's some weird meta commentary where at like the halfway point, the Joker literally takes over the movie and turns it into just the shitty Joker show. I don't know. But,
and it's obvious at a lot of points that Nicholson's ad-libbing.
But he got so much attention at the time, and I feel like people who haven't seen the movie in a long time, he's what they remember, and how great he was, and boy, Jack Nicholson was the perfect Joker.
No.
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 And I wonder, I mean, the people that say that, I don't know necessarily what they mean by that, how many of them have maybe read the comics or are familiar enough with the Joker character to say such a thing, but... He's just kind of hammy and not funny.
I think in the world...
And not scary, although your son was very scared of him in 1989.
By this time the video had come out.
Okay.
So it's...
It's still that year. It came out like at Christmas of 89. That was a big deal.
But my son wasn't born until 1990.
Oh,
so
okay.
I think we're looking at my son at 2 or 3.
Okay.
Who found the image of Jack Nicholson's Joker to be very scary... And when my mother-in-law would babysit him, she would have to hide my brother-in-law's VHS copy of Batman because it freaked him out.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in many performers, there is a desire to be loved because certainly this is one of the many reasons why you might go into performing because you need thousands of people to applaud and vindicate or validate your existence. And as mean or ugly or killing as Nicholson's Joker may be, I think at the heart of it, there's this performer who still wants our love, that he's putting on this little clown show for our love. And one of the things I thought was amazing about Heath Ledger's performance is he has no interest in our affection or our love.
And he earns it anyway
and does,
because he's so great.
And does things in that movie. I remember watching an interview with Christopher Nolan, and he said the first couple days shooting... Ledger kept doing this thing where he licked his lips, and Nolan could not figure out for the life of him why he was doing it until he started watching the dailies and saw the effect it has. And what I always compare that to is Johnny Depp, when he was in the first Pirates movie, he is giving something that's very different, and I've heard the Disney execs back at home were watching the dailies and literally saying, what the fuck is he doing? That... You're willing to go out on a ledge and do something really completely different and not have this little wink to the camera.
Right.
You still love me, don't you?
Which is all Nicholson's performance is.
And I find the performances that aren't sort of slavishly looking for my love or asking me to see the real performer underneath are the performances I like the least, because I can't be alone in the fact that one of the things I like so much about The Dark Knight is Ledger's performance.
Oh, absolutely. And again, like I said, he ends up earning our affection and our love, not because we love he's a lovable character, but because we're all just so blown away by how good he is that we love that performance and that character.
I love that moment when he's riding in the car and he sticks his head out the window like a dog. and breathes in the night air. Ledger's performance in The Dark Knight is so good, it killed him.
Again, I've said this before on the podcast, but when he was announced, I was already annoyed that they were going to do the Joker.
Oh, it was the same thing as Michael Keaton as Batman.
Yeah.
People went apeshit.
Well, I definitely was like, really? I just felt like he was too young, and I hadn't seen him in anything that I really felt like, okay. Because nobody...
Because nobody he was consistently being cast in this direction.
Right.
And look what some of these performers
right.
can do
oh,
when
no.
you...
He's fantastic. But again, maybe because what I was picturing was the Nicholson Joker, where I just... Because nobody knew what he was going to do with that character. I just thought, well, how is he going to... How can he be the Joker? Because I'm picturing goofy guy in makeup, not knowing that he's going to be this amazing other thing. So I was against it. Yeah, and seeing it, and I remember immediately after seeing The Dark Knight, I think the first time in 2008 or whatever, knowing that, oh, I can never go back and watch Nicholson's Joker again, because he's a birthday clown.
I mean, I was going to say that...
he's Ronald McDonald.
We've discussed this before, either on the blog or on a podcast, that there's all these famous actors who just have this moment where a fuse gets blown. And they decide to do something instead of what they used to do. And I've always contended for Nicholson, it was The Shining.
Yeah.
Although, oddly enough, he went so farther over the top later in his career that when I saw The Shining again after many years at the massacre,
yeah.
I actually had a different reaction to his performance, because I think that's the first time that he was really rewarded for going over the top. But considering how far over the top he went in other things, you go back and parts of The Shining look positively restrained.
Right.
With Pacino, it's Scent of a Woman. With De Niro, where was it that De Niro went off the tracks?
I guess Meet the Parents? I guess? Maybe analyze this?
Is Dustin Hoffman the last one from that generation to not...
Well, what would an exaggerated Dustin Hoffman performance look like?
Well, interestingly enough, according to my students, it might be Rain Man, because...
I forgot it. Of course it's Rain Man. Rain Man is horrible.
When I... Oh, I hate Rain Man, too.
Oh, Jesus.
And we have Dustin Hoffman. I have to say it.
Okay.
What? And the Black Hole. Okay, that's all I'm going to say.
Tom Cruise gives a better performance than Dustin Hoffman in that movie.
Well, again, in the words of Ben Stiller in Tropic Thunder, that's a great scene. Dustin Hoffman knows what he's doing. When I show my students The Graduate, yeah. which they've never seen, they think his performance as Benjamin has some things in common with Raymond. Excuse me, his name isn't Raymond.
Yeah, it is.
Oh, I thought that was the Tom Cruise character's name. Oh, Tom Cruise used to call him Rain Man because Tom Cruise was younger and he couldn't say Raymond.
Maybe. His name's Raymond, yeah.
Okay. That...
Oh, I hate that movie.
There are aspects...
It just reminded me of how much
there
I
are
don't
aspects
like that movie.
Of the Rain Man performance
yeah.
that you can visibly see in Benjamin.
Interesting.
The hesitation, the halting,
right,
the...
Right.
Stuff like that.
Ugh. I don't like that movie.
Rain Man.
Yeah.
2 weeks ago, the Music Box showed a 35mm print of The Graduate, and I got a chance to see it, and it looked beautiful, and we've done a podcast on it, and I made an interesting decision. I never have to see The Graduate ever again.
You're done? That's it?
I'm getting to the point where there's a couple of these films.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why?
Yeah.
It's memorized. Yeah. Back to Batman.
Yes. It also set, you know, not only did it set a template on movie marketing, and so now every year, Batman is what we're chasing. I remember the next year, Dick Tracy came out and really tried to do the same thing, misguidedly so, because Dick Tracy was never going to be Batman. And but also set a template for what every other Batman movie would look like until Christopher Nolan came along, where in every movie we have a different... utterly disposable sort of love interest. I mean, what Vicky Vale is doing in this movie, I couldn't even tell you, except that, hey, they needed an actress, and Sean Young had a writing accident. But
I keep thinking, I actually give Kim Basinger some credit, because she was a very last-minute substitution.
Yeah.
And I don't think she's awful. Has Sean Young had a series of writing accidents?
No, it was this one.
It was this.
But literally shit-canned her entire career after this. I mean...
But when was Wall Street made?
Earlier, 87, 88?
Because something happened on Wall Street.
Really?
Where she was in a lot less of that movie than she was supposed to be.
Could it have been the same writing accident? Or could they have been shooting around the same time?
Perhaps. I just, every time Sean Young's career comes up, it's writing accident, you're done. Which, on the making of, yeah. She admits to.
Yeah.
She literally says, there's a point at which your career can go here or go here.
She was going to be the female lead in Batman, which is fascinating, knowing who Sean Young is now. You're like, really? She was ever a big enough star to do that? Because then she famously shows up in the cat suit to try and be Catwoman.
And
that didn't happen. And that was supposed to be Annette Bening, and then she got pregnant, so it ended up being Michelle Pfeiffer. But also that the movies are much more interested in the villains than they are in Batman, even in the Schumacher ones.
Yeah.
So we have to get the origin of the villain, and then we spend all this time on the villain. And with Tim Burton, I get it to an extent, because again, that's his sympathies lie with... Because
the villains are dark and misunderstood.
Right?
Tell you about my childhood? I used to sit at home in the dark and watch Dark Shadows, and I said to myself, one day I'll ruin this.
I got fired from Disney. Wah. So to some extent, I do have to give Batman credit for at least trying to, to some extent it took a comic book story seriously enough that maybe...
For the first hour.
that it demonstrated that, like, hey, maybe these are viable things to make into movies. And again, that's both a blessing and a curse, because now at this point, there's so many goddamn comic book movies that I'm like, all right, guys, stop. Take a break. I mean, the 12-year-old me is happy, but this me is like, enough already. But it's also interesting because as much as you think, wow, Batman really started this trend of comic book movies, no, it didn't, because the 90s... Except for the other three Batman movies.
Right.
There's really nothing until X-Men comes along in 2000.
It was a very self-contained phenomenon. Months ago, Mike said something very wonderful on the podcast that I've sort of filed away in my brain. That if someone had told the 12-year-old me, oh, now I feel like I'm doing a Patton Oswalt routine that doesn't exist. If someone had told the 12-year-old me, when you get a little older... all of your favorite things are going to be in a movie every week.
Yeah.
What would your reaction have been?
Right.
And now we get it, and your reaction is stop.
Yeah.
Please stop.
It's this sort of bored indifference. It's very hard for me to go back and watch Batman without, and it does not suffer from that whole nostalgia thing where I watch it and I love it because I loved it at one point, but it is a movie that I'm so overly familiar with because I saw it so many times that I'm watching it just as almost this rote memorization. It's just, I remember all these lines, I remember all these scenes, and I'm indifferent to what works and what doesn't. But when I do stop and think about it for the purposes of the podcast, I recognize very little of it actually works as a movie.
No, and oddly enough, I think the best stuff is at the beginning.
Yeah, the first like 40 minutes or
and
so.
And really sets the template for the rest of Tim Burton's career, because rewatching Batman again for this podcast, it made me realize how much I dislike his work, how few movies he's made I really think work as an entire movie, and to a certain extent, Dark Shadows is Batman played at top speed, because I would suggest the first 10 minutes of Dark Shadows is really something and captures the tone. And then it gets jokey and goes into the toilet. What if the entire movie were the first 10 minutes? And right. I talked about this before. All of these moody, gothic, teenage girl vampire stories are so popular. Why can't you play it straight?
Yeah.
And oddly enough, one of the few times he has played it straight, I think because the material itself was so weird and jokey and ironic to begin with. The one of the few times he does play it straight in Ed Wood.
Yeah.
I think that's his greatest film.
Oh, easily. I think that's, I would argue that's his only movie that works 100% of the way. You know what I mean? I think he's got other movies that work in varying degrees. I think almost every one of his movies you could point to and say, I like this thing. Even Planet of the Apes, I could say, I like the makeup.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. There's other movies that I could say I like 3/4 of it.
You know?
I mean, I like a lot of Edward Scissorhands, but I don't think it really works as a movie. Even same with Beetlejuice. I mean, there's a lot of stuff I like in Beetlejuice. But I would say Ed Wood and maybe Pee-wee's Big Adventure, I think, are the only two movies he's made that really work 100% of the way through.
Yeah. That the rest of them are a mixed bag.
Yeah.
But I'm just, you bring that up, and the first thing I think of is Mars Attacks.
Yeah.
And there's things in Mars Attacks I like.
Yeah.
And then there's things in Mars Attacks that are just odd.
Well, it's very much a one-joke movie. I mean, it's one joke over and over and over again.
And by that, I want to make sure I have the joke correct.
We try and make friends with the alien, and then the alien shoots us.
Right. And I think what made me like the film so much when it originally came out, I actually saw that twice in a movie theater that Christmas season, is I think that's a really funny joke. When the Martian says, we will not harm you, and then shoot someone and they become a skeleton, that's really funny.
Somebody, though, I think it's Dana Gould, the comedian Dana Gould, who's incredibly smart, made a great point about Mars Attacks, which is that for Mars Attacks to work, all of the actors in the movie have to be playing it completely straight. The alien is what's funny. The alien is the comedy. But you have all these actors who are so busy giving funny performances and being ridiculous that it stops working, because now you have all these things competing to be wacky.
And I would argue that's fascinating. And I recently found out that Dana Gould is a big monster kid.
Yeah.
He's in that documentary, Beast Wishes,
okay,
about Bob and Kathy Burns. That's,
he supported Mayla Nurmi for, like, lots of her life.
Yeah.
Like, he was finding her a place to live.
Puts his money where his mouth is.
Yeah.
That Dana Gould is right on target, because when I think back at the stuff in that film that I think works, I think Jim Brown is not trying to give a jokey performance, and it works. I think Lucas Haas is very genuine and not giving a jokey performance, and Sylvia Sidney is not giving a jokey performance. It's Joe Don Baker and Jack Black and Jack Nicholson and Annette Bening and Glenn Close.
Jack Nicholsons for Sarah Jessica Parker, Pierce Brosnan, Martin Short. Yeah.
That they're all trying to out jokey each other,
yeah,
and really the only ones who vindicate themselves are the people who are a little bit more grounded.
Yeah. So anyway, that's Batman, everyone.
We kind of got off subject there.
Yeah.
But this is nothing new.
Sorry if you love this movie, everyone. You can still love it just because we have problems with it.
No. If you love this movie, you're wrong. And I feel now, fueled by Monster Energy Drink, that I am willing to take on the 12-year-old you. And if it truly is the 12-year-old you, I will wrestle you to the ground, because you're 12 and I have a tremendous weight advantage. And I will hold your arm behind your back until you scream, Uncle, Batman by Tim Burton is a mess.